Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. I'm pleased to introduce this evening's guest speaker, number one New York Times bestselling author Patricia Briggs. Now, if you go digging around, you quickly realize that Patricia is not a fan of author bios. And even after numerous requests from entities relying on publicity, one can see a pretty entertaining refusal of writing an author bio. So here's what I can tell you. Patricia is a dream chaser, and ever since her first novel, Masks, debuted in 1993, she's been supplying the world with urban fantasy at the rate of roughly one book per year. And so I think as far as dream chasers go, she's done pretty well because she's a best-selling author now. So tonight, she is here to present the next installment of the Alpha and Omega series, Fair Game. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Patricia Briggs.
Welcome. I love your story. This is really cool. You guys are really lucky. This is a neat, neat place. I've heard about it for a long time. My sister lives in Red Lodge, Montana. She's a doctor in Red Lodge, Montana. And when they absolutely can't bear living in a small town anymore, they come to Denver and shop here. So she's been telling me to come here for years. Now I can write to her and go, ha ha, I was here. I thought I would start out with a reading from Fair Game, since that's the book that's out. And then we'll do some Q&A. And it's a small group today, which makes it really awesome. It means you can ask whatever you want to, and I can tell you things that I can make you swear that not to tell anybody else, all right? If you have the book, I'm going to do it. And I don't do long readings, generally speaking, because, I'm not an audiobook actress. I am not the best reader in the world, and the Q&A is so much more fun. So that being said, I'm going to start on page 77. Now, you can all hear me, right? I have a little hard time with microphones trying to figure out how good this is, but this actually is an awesome. I'm not getting any feedback, which is really nice. Okay. All right, halfway down page 77, if you want to read along. Let's see, where am I going to start? There I'm going to start. Okay. All right, he said. We can go change and do some more touristy stuff. He was reading her through their bond. Actually, how many of you have read the Anna and Charles books at all? Okay. All right, so we have Anna and Charles. They are both werewolves. And Charles is his father's headhunter, troubleshooter. He gets sent off to go do things like kill lots of werewolves is mostly what his job is, to keep the peace and keep humans from getting too scared of them and figuring out that werewolves really are monsters and not these nice guys in uniforms who go and rescue people. Because once people figure out that, then it's going to be an open war. And so that's been his job for a long time. And as Fair Game takes place in the same time period now as the Mercy Thompson series, this book happens right on the tail end of Rivermarked, which means it's been a couple of years. The last book was Hunting Ground. And I finally got tired of writing books in two different timelines. And trying to explain to people, no, you don't understand. I know Hunting Ground came out, I don't know, when was it? It was after Silverborn, right? But it really happened like right after Moon Called, like four books back. So I decided to catch up, and that's what Fair Game is. At this point in time, Anna and Charles have been sent to Boston. There's a serial killer who's been killing werewolves, and instead of sending Charles out to kill more werewolves, he's been sent out to find out who is and how they are killing werewolves and also Fae, because they're kind of tough critters, right? All right. And so they've done their consulting with the FBI, and they're kind of waiting for people to do things. And in the meantime, they're exploring Boston. I'm going to bend this down just a little bit so I can read and talk at the same time. All right, he said, and this is Charles. We can go and change and do some more touristy stuff. He was reading her through their bond, hiding the warm fuzzies that gave her behind a distressful look. Anna took a bite of her sandwich and said, okay, but only if you agree to do this with me. And she took her now bedraggled map out of her back pocket and tapped a finger on an advertisement. Charles looked, heaved a long sigh. I should have known we wouldn't get out of here without doing the imitation trolley car cemetery tour, complete with costume ghouls. Not in my territory, snarled someone behind her. As it seemed an unlikely response to Charles' pseudo-reluctant agreement, Anna initially assumed it was directed at someone else. But Charles tilted his head, lowered his eyelids, and the muscles tightened subtly in his shoulder, so Anna turned around in her seat to see who had spoken. In the rows along the outdoor marketplace were dozens of dark green wagons resembling nothing so much as the covered wagons in her father's beloved old Western movies. The wagons served as kiosks where people sold T-shirts, purses, and other small portable goods. Standing on the top of the one nearest them was a young-looking black man, fine-boned and slight, watching Charles, anyway, with yellow eyes, as the strings of beading supplies hanging from hooks all over the wagon swayed unsteadily. From photos, she recognized him as Isaac Owens, the alpha of the Old Town pack, Boston being the old town complete with the final ease. He wasn't in a habit of running around on tops of unlikely purchase, or he'd have been in the local paper a lot more than he already was. You're attracting attention, said Charles in a conversational tone designed not to carry to human ears. Isaac, being a werewolf, would hear him just fine despite being a dozen yards away. Do you really want that? I'm out. They know who I am, projecting his voice to anyone who cared to listen, and people were starting to pause what they were doing to listen. Isaac raised his chin aggressively. What about you? Charles shrugged. In, out, doesn't matter. He leaned forward and lowered his voice. No more does your declaration. You lost control of the situation that brings me here when you chose not to report the deaths in your territory. You have no say over what I do or don't do. We didn't kill anyone, Isaac declared and pointed at Charles, and you will have to go through me to take any of my pack. Isaac was new, Anna remembered, knew at his job, knew at being a wolf, and like her, he'd been a college student when he'd been changed. Normally, it would have been years before he was alpha, no matter how much potential dominance he had. But the Old Town pack had lost its alpha last year in a freak sailing accident, and Isaac, who had been second, had stepped in to do his job. His second was an old wolf who probably didn't know anything at all about this stunt. The woman who was working the kiosk, her body bestrewn with hand-beaded jewelry and tattoos in a bewildered mixture of color and texture, was backing slowly away, trying not to draw attention to herself. Not a bad strategy for someone caught between predators, although less glittery jewelry might have helped. Another reason for Anna not to wear her diamonds. If no laws were broken, no one is at risk, said Charles, and Isaac sneered. Get off the stupid wagon before the poor lady calls 911, Anna said, exasperated. Come introduce yourself, Isaac, and see what happens. She said it loudly enough she was clearly audible to the crowd of people that was forming a ring around them, close enough to see what was going on, not so close as to get involved. That meant she was speaking almost as loudly as Isaac had been. The local alpha looked at her for the first time and frowned. His nostrils flared as he tried to catch her scent, which would have been impossible to filter from the rest of the people nearby, except that she smelled like an Omega wolf. After a rather long pause, Isaac shrugged his shoulders to loosen the muscles and walked off into the wagon, a good 9 or 10 foot drop. He landed with flexed knees and turned to the proprietor of the shop, who'd stopped when Anna had drawn attention to her. "My apologies," he told her. "I didn't mean to scare you." He smiled and handed her a card. A friend of mine runs a pub. Stop by and have a meal on us. The woman took the card with a rather shaky hand, steadied as Isaac's smile warmed. She glanced down and her eyebrows rose. I've eaten there. Good fish and chips. I think so too, he said, gave her a wink and strolled over to where Anna and Charles sat. Nice PR, Anna said, although considering what went before, I'm not inclined to give you an A for it. He studied her, ignoring Charles's brooding presence. "Ah, yeah, nah," he said, exaggerating his Boston accent into incomprehensible nasal sounds before he dropped most of it to continue more clearly. "What in the hell are you?" "Good to meet you, too," Anna said. "I bet that card was your second's idea, wasn't it? To make up for your lack of manners?" She dropped her voice and added a touch of Boston to it. "Oops," and I can't do that. I don't have a really good Boston accent. "Oops, sorry I destroyed your car. Here, have a meal on me." "Was that your dog I ate? Oh, sorry. Have a drink at my friend's pub and forget all about it." Isaac grinned, a sudden charming expression that showed white teeth in his blue-black face. "Caught me, darling. But you didn't answer my question." "She is mine," said Charles. His aggressive answer didn't show up in his voice, which was low and calm. "We have a meeting scheduled tomorrow with you and your pack. There was no need for this." He glanced around. People were still watching them, but they were pretending not to. "Theater," he finished. "This is Boston, Haas." Isaac bent his knees and squatted, putting his head on a level with theirs. I don't do Boston accents. We're all about theater here. He pronounced the second theater. Excuse me, I did it backwards. Okay, we're all about theater here. He pronounced the second theater just as Charles had. He wasn't native to Boston, she remembered. She thought he was from Michigan or Pennsylvania. Anna gave him the gimlet eye and spoke to Charles. He was probably walking by and spotted us, decided he couldn't wait until tomorrow to throw a hissy fit. "And aren't you one to burst everyone's posturing?" Isaac's dark eyes considered her. And then in a more down-to-earth tone, he looked at Charles and said, "As a matter of fact, she's right." And then his face and his voice went very, very serious. "I meant what I said. To get to my wolves, you have to go over my dead body." And we'll stop there. So I'm going to give you fair warning for next. I don't have a watch. Somebody have a watch and tell me what time it is? 7:41. So for the next 20-25 minutes, maybe 30 minutes, if we get going here, I am going to talk to you. And if you want questions answered, you can ask questions. Otherwise, I'll just talk, and that might be painful. So I'm going to see if anybody has any burning questions they'd like to ask, and you can ask them about either series, this book, or the next book, or whatever you would like to ask. Yes. Do you have a favorite child? Do you have it's whatever I'm working on right now is really the way it works. And part of that is because if I'm not enjoying what I'm doing the best, then I shouldn't be working on that. I should be working on something else. I can tell you the Mercy series writes faster for me. Mercy is a clearer voice in my head. I hear her better. She's easier. Charles is easy for me too, but Anna has always been difficult. She's a more subtle character than Mercy is, and she surprises me a lot, which I like. But it does mean that sometimes I'll get all the way through the stupid book and go, "Oh, wait a minute! No, that's why I didn't like this." And I have to go back and fix the whole thing, because she has decided that she's going to do something different towards the beginning of the book, which really sucks. So, and I have to say, you know, I really like the traditional fantasy too. Dragon Bones, the main character. I don't know if any of you have read them, but the main character for Dragon Bones is the most fun character I've ever written in my life, because he is outwardly so different than what he is inwardly. He's a huge guy. He's a fighter. He had some brain damage from when his father beat him when he was a kid. So he talks kind of slowly, and he knows that it makes people think he's stupid. And so he talks even more slowly because he thinks it's funny that people think. Yeah, and he has other reasons for it too, but he has a real justification for it. But that means that I get to write these scenes in which you, the reader, and I, and my main character all know that he's really smart, and he's dealing with people who all think he's really stupid. And in my favorite scene to write ever, he's talking to his uncle, and he tells his uncle that you have to be smarter than the horse, knowing that his uncle doesn't think he's smarter than a horse. And it's just one of those kind of happy, warm moments in a writer's life, right? Yes?
Did you have much input in how your characters were drawn to the graphic novels?
Yes and no. Boy, the graphic novels were quite a stressful thing. It hurt that we got in with the Dable brothers. I don't know if you know, the Dable brothers are geniuses, and they are also con artists. And they don't pay their artists, and they don't pay their writers, which irks me. And what happens is they have a really good idea, and they're willing to build these beautiful, beautiful graphic novels, and then leave everybody else holding the bag. When Homecoming came out finally as a hardback from Del Rey with a beautiful Dos Santos cover, Daniel Dos Santos cover, he's the one who does all of my urban fantasy books. I found out afterwards, after it had been on the New York Times for like 6 weeks, I found out that David Lawrence, who is my writer, and Amelia Wu, my artist, had not been paid for it yet. So I paid them for it and basically started breaking my contract with Dable Brothers because I said, that's not acceptable. I'm not going to put my name there. We were doing the comic book, knowing that, you know, I hadn't received any money for the comic books at that point, was kind of finally figuring out that I probably wouldn't with the Dable Brothers, but that was okay because I make my money writing books. But it wasn't okay they were using my name to make other people put in a lot of effort and a lot of work. And these people use this money to pay their bills and to keep their houses, right? And weren't paying them, and that wasn't okay. And right in the middle of that, they sold everything they had to Dynamite. And Dynamite is a much better, a much more up-and-up comic book company. Nick Barucci, who runs it, is an honest person. He's not particularly generous, and he's not a genius like the Dable brothers are. But people get paid, and they know they're going to get paid, and they get paid when he says they're going to get paid, which is really important to me. So when we got the first artist, who was Francis Tsai for Homecoming, and he did the first two issues, I was thrilled to death. He did a really awesome job. We went through about 15 artists, and for some reason, nobody could get the fact that the werewolves were wolves and not man-wolves things. And my favorite one was they sent me this, and I don't understand why they're sending me this, because they supposedly have read the books. They sent me this photo of Mercy, supposedly in her coyote form, I suppose, and she had, like, 6 boobs. I'm not kidding. It was I have it somewhere on my laptop because we saved it because it was just, I mean, laugh out loud funny. I'm going, what are these people thinking? It's crazy. But Francis Tsai is, and I think he's going to be one of the big artists in the next 10 or 15 years. He's just incredibly good. He, of course, wrote to me after the comic books came out in kind of weird chunks. They didn't come out. They couldn't give me a schedule. And I got a really nice note from Francis Tsai at the end of the first comic had come out. And he said, you know, I'm so sorry. I have all of the artwork done for the second comic, but I won't give it to them until they pay me for the first one. And I said, you go. Yes. And that was my first clue that they weren't paying people. When Francis Tsai was hired by Marvel, and he signed an exclusive agreement with Marvel, and that's a really huge up. That's awesome. We picked Amelia Wu to continue, and she's just gotten better and better. I didn't realize how young she was. They had a little glitch in the last Mercy Mooncalled that slowed down because she had to do her finals in school. So she's a baby, and she just gets better and better. And some of the things I really like, I love the way they've portrayed Daryl. I had a different idea for Daryl in my head, and when I saw the first sketches from Francis Tsai on Daryl, that's him, and I replaced it. I don't particularly care for their Mercy, but I'm not sure that somebody could draw a Mercy that I would be happy with, right? That would still probably make a good comic book. So it's a give and take. I feel more like a grandmother with the comic books than I do like a mother. I have a certain amount of say. I can jump in and say, you're doing it wrong and stop everything. But otherwise, I kind of let them run with it and go, oh, that's so cool, right? Thank you. Yes.
Into the to the point where I can say, please choose this person. We have some, Lorelei King does the Mercy Books, and she has a wonderful voice. And Holter, and I want to say Graham, and my brain, is it Holter Graham? Oh, I Holden, yes. Oh, I love the way he does the Alpha and Omega books. And then, my favorite Audible books, my favorite audiobooks were done by... it's not brilliance. I'm totally lost. Sorry, it's been. I'm not even really far into the tour. This is the third book signing I've done. So I should have a brain left, and I don't. but when they did Dragon Bones and Dragon Blood, they had. He plays Alcides in the. Thank you. Joe Manganiello. Oh, wow. He did Dragon Bones and Dragon Blood. And boy, can he do stupid. I just... And he's got a great voice anyway. I mean, I could listen to him read the phone book and enjoy it. But he obviously had a great time when he was doing Dragon Bones and Dragon Blood. And in the section where Ward is trying to be stupid, he just... nails it. It's awesome. So those are really my favorites. But Lorelei King is, I love her when she, I grabbed her because we used to listen to the Janet Ivanovich CDs when we were on trips with our kids. And all of us were just enthralled. She does such wonderful voices. So yes, but that's all the control I have. I don't get to go and do minute changes. I do have a funny story about audiobooks. Do you want to hear a funny story about audiobooks? Okay. Early on in my career, Terry Brooks lives in Seattle, right? I've never met him. When I was a mid-list author with two books under my belt and one that wasn't selling, we moved to Washington State, and my husband took my CIFWA, Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association, address book and looked to see who was in Washington State and said, "Hey, look, Terry Brooks lives here. We should contact him." And I said, "Oh, no. You're not contacting Terry Brooks. I'm a peon. You don't know." So I went to work and I got a call. Guess what? He called Terry Brooks on the phone and had a wonderful conversation with him. And Terry agreed to look at the book that wasn't selling. And he gave me some really awesome advice and helped me fix it. It's a much better book. When Demons Walk is a much better book. He didn't edit it. He didn't line edit it. He just gave me some improvement ideas. And I have used a lot of the advice he gave me ever since then. But in the meantime, he was telling me about some of his experiences as a writer. And one of the ones was he was one of the very first authors that they put on audio tapes. And they asked him, and he said, "Oh, yes." He said, "But have the artist call me before they read because I want to go through and do a pronunciation guide." Right? And he said, "Okay." And then the next thing he knew, they called him and said, "Hey, we're done. Do you want the tapes?" Because this is back in the days of tapes. And he said, "Just tell me how he pronounced the title of the book." Okay, it's 76, Sword of Shannara came out, and I pronounced it the Sword of Shannara like everybody else in the whole of the United States, and that's not how it's pronounced. No, wait a minute. No, I pronounce it Shannara, right? The Sword of Shannara, like everybody else in the United States. And so did his artist who was reading the book for him, and he made them redo the whole tapes because it's Shannara. He's an 800-pound gorilla. He can do things like that. But anyway, he sent me this wonderful, I have this coffee, well, not coffee, what did I spill on? I spilled cocoa on it, I think, stained letter that he gave me telling me all the things I did wrong. And it's in my book of things that will leave my cold dead fingers, kind of thing. Okay. Do I have another question? I told you I could talk at you all day long, right? Yes.
One of my favorite characters is one of your minor characters, Z.
Oh, Z. I love Z.
Have you ever thought about just doing something with the pig and the community that they have around that?
Yes. And when you read the end of Fair Game, you'll see why I've been waiting till now. Okay. I'm going to stop there. I won't say anything more because I don't want to give anything away. But Z is based on my Volkswagen mechanic. Seriously, we've had Volkswagens. My daughter has a Jetta TDI now, but we had two Volkswagen Vanagons, three Jettas, four Jettas, including my daughter's, a Passat wagon, a Eurovan Suck, and various other things. And we owned them when we were dead broke, and that meant my husband had to fix them most of the time. And our Volkswagen mechanic, who also sold all the old Volkswagen parts, and he sold them at cost. Nobody does that, right? He sold them at cost. And he was very inexpensive when he did fix things, and they knew their stuff, so they could fix them really fast, so that was made even less expensive. But the first two or three years I knew him, Buck was about my height, weighed probably 90 pounds, soaking wet, all of it rye muscle, and the sourest expression you ever saw on a human face. And you'd walk in, and you'd talk to him, and he'd... you know, just like and snaps, and he's running a business, right? Which explains why it's so cheap, right? And one day I went in, my husband came in to me and he said, oh, the gas cap fell off the van again. You need to go get a new gas cap. So I went into Bucks and I said, I need a new gas cap because the gas cap fell off the van again. And he said, gas caps don't fall off vanigans. And I said, my husband came in this morning and said the gas cap fell off the van again, and I am a good wife, so the gas cap fell off the van again. And he threw his head back, and he howled. He laughed his head off. And after that, we were great friends. He was just incredibly shy. He had the biggest heart of anybody I've ever met. I mean, he would take people up off the street. He would, you know, he's just a great man. I came in one day, and I said, I looked at he and his son who worked with him. I said, boy, you guys look pretty rough. And he said, well, we had a five-year-old girl disappear in Kennewick out of her house. She disappeared. And he and his son, both sons, but just the one was there, had spent the whole night going door to door, knocking on doors, looking for her. That's the kind of guy he was. He was dying of lung cancer when I started Moon Called, and I went up to him and I said, I already knew that I wanted Mercy to be a mechanic. And as I was trying to figure out how to organize the world, I thought, oh, he would make such a great character. So I went over to him and I asked him, I said, would you mind? And I have never done this before. I have sense. There's one other guy who is responsible for one of my characters. But I went up to him and I said, would you mind if I use you for one of my characters for my story? And he was tickled to death. He just, you know, we had it. He was just beside himself. He passed away before Moon Called came out. But he was just, you know, and Z is a lot nastier than he ever was. But I can really see him, you know, kicking some butt. So that was fun. And that's why Z is the way Z is. Yes?
Do you have a Manx?
I have had. And I did when we were writing this. And it was my mother-in-law's old cat. She was like 12 or 13 when I wrote Moon Called. And she was exactly that. She never met a stranger. And she would just... But occasionally the family members she'd punish. She'd get mad at you and she wouldn't sit on you. And so you would have friends over and she would come over and she would sit on somebody's lap and she would look at you. And then she would go and she'd sit on the next person's lap and she would look at you. And then she would go and sit on the next person's lap and look at you. And then she would stalk around you and then jump up on the next person's lap. But she was totally not a cat. Manxes aren't cats. That's my theory is I don't know what they are, but they have their personality is so uncat-like. I grew up in Siamese, which are the epitome of cats, and she was fascinated me. So when I gave Mercy a cat, I thought I'm not going to give her a standard cat. I'm going to give her a Manx and see what happens. Oh! So your Manx is, what is your Manx like?
He has he's very standoffish.
Oh,
he's affectionate.
He doesn't purr. Oh, wow. I think my understanding is that actually is kind of unusual for Manxes because I've talked to other people who've had them and Medea is actually more like most Manxes are than not. But, you know, it takes all... he may be standoffish cat. That's, you know, that's
he's
the...
He's becoming more fun. It's been about 2 years now, and he's mellowing. I hope when he's 12,
He will go and drape himself on people's laps. I was at a science fiction convention, and I was sitting in a green room. That's where they stick all the authors when you want to be off stage, with Tamara Pierce, and she wrote Blood and Chocolate. My brain is stupid. Silver Kiss. You know who I'm talking about, right? She has the most lovely British accent, too. I want to tell you, she's awesome. And there were several others. There were like five of us, women fantasy writers. And between us, we had like 35 cats. I have only two now. I started out last year with four, and we only have two now. So I suspect we'll gather more as we go along. One of them went home with my daughter, who moved out into her own apartment. So we're kind of feeling catless at the moment. Yes?
I think that obviously everyone's aware that who you are as an individual affects your stories.
Absolutely.
But I was just wondering over time if you've noticed how your stories have affected you.
Oh, yeah. Actually, one of the things that being a writer does is it makes you pull back and look at other people's point of views. More than maybe you would normally, because you might use that in a book, and you have to be able to understand how the other side thinks, and that has affected my whole life. That I have always been able to see the other side of the argument, no matter what my convictions are. When I was in high school, my teacher took me aside. He had debates. He had the Civil War and the Revolutionary War. In the Revolutionary War, he had the British side and the American side arguing who caused the war, and the Civil War, the North and the South. And he put me on the British side of the Revolutionary War, and then he would grade you on facts and then on emotionalism. And he said this was the first year in 25 years of teaching that the British won on emotionalism. So that really does affect it, and it keeps me from being too extreme in any of my views, because I can see the other person's side, and I find that very valuable as a human being. Zealots scare me. Bran is a zealot, and one of the reasons I've never written a book, I probably will not, although I used to say I never will, and now it's probably I won't, is because he is a zealot, and that makes him do some really heinous things that somebody of his personality type and his intelligence probably would normally never do. And so, you know, you would play with it all. Okay, yes. Okay, I always knew I told stories. I didn't know real people wrote books. We had books in our house. My mother was a librarian. We all read. We'd sit down. My mother used to walk in. We see the big, you know, when they did the big campaign and you see the big signs that said, read with your children once a day. My sister and I laugh because my mom would come in. You guys, put your books down. Go outside. The sun is shining. So the books have always been a big part of my life. I read a lot. I also used to draw. I can draw a pretty good pretty good girl, because I was like in middle school when I was doing this, dragons and horses and sometimes dogs. And I would draw these things and people would say, well, what's this about? And so I would write little scenes until I was satisfied that when people asked me, people ask the dumbest questions. I don't know. It's a girl sitting on a dragon. Why does it have to be about something? So I always did that. I just wrote little scenes. But it wasn't until I was in college that I sat down to write a book. And it was because a good friend of mine wrote books. She was 22, 23, and she had stacks of spiral-bound notebooks. That was the era before the personal computer. That's how old I am. stacks of spiral-bound notebooks all over her dorm room, and they were pretty good stories. And I thought, how cool would it be to finish a book, to write a book? And so I wrote the first 10 pages of Masks for about 5 years. I'd write it, and I'd say, oh, you have to read this. And my poor, loving husband read that first 10 pages. I don't know, but he still has parts of it memorized. That's how bad it was. And then we moved to Chicago after we got out of school. Mike was an aquarist for the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, which is a really, we've had some really cool jobs. And I moved
Montana, with a total population at that time about 800,000 people. Billings, Montana was the largest city in Montana. It had 68,000 people. And the Hancock Tower in Chicago, I think it's 72,000 people go to work there every day. I was really out of my element, and I hid in the book, and I wrote masks hiding from 7.5 million people in Chicago. So, yes. No, actually, the end of one of the things that I like to tell people is that if you've only been reading the Mercy Thompson series, you have to read Fair Game, because the next book, Frostburned, I'm working on it right now, starts right on the heels of this. It starts on Black Friday. Mercy takes Jesse out shopping on Black Friday, which I've only ever done once this year with my good friend who's now my personal assistant, and it was the scariest moment of my life, really. You don't know terror until you're in Walmart and you realize that you can't move forward, you can't move back, you can't move side, and neither can the other 10,000 people in the store. That's pretty crazy. So I use that, of course, and but it does happen right on the heels of Fair Game. So you'll see some of that from the twist at the end of Fair Game. You'll see some of that. And also, I'm trying to boost my speed up again. This last year really was hell. We started an addition on a house. And take my advice, don't ever do that. If you don't like your house, if it's not big enough for you, sell it and buy something else. You never know what you're going to find. We broke into our roof and found that the roof was bad. And on the day that I left for the last signing tour for Rivermarked, I found out that we had to move out of the house. They had to tear the roof off of our house. And then we didn't realize until several months later that the person we had hired, the general contractor we had hired, and we're paying, you know, probably better than average. Well, I know it was better than average because we've talked to people since then, was a moron and incompetent and had no idea what he was doing. He pulled the roof off our house in March, and it rained all March and April. Even the Tri-Cities, it does rain. And it ruined every piece of flooring in the house. It ruined the kitchen in the house. It ruined all the bathrooms in the house. It ruined my daughter's antique piano. It ruined my husband's oak desk. My husband, when I left, he was down with pneumonia. And when I got back from the tour, we had 2 days, and I had to go to France with him. My daughters lived with my good friend for 2.5 months until we finally realized that his two-week estimate was wrong, and that wasn't going to work out. And so we bought Mike and I lived in my office trailer, which is it's a construction trailer, and I bought it used from a company who said we're going to either sell this or throw it out because it doesn't seal, the windows don't seal, the doors don't seal. I'm no longer afraid of spiders. Because they ran across my face every night for 9 months. It's just unholy, crazy. And we bought a travel trailer so my daughters could live next to us because it's the last summer we're going to have them. My daughters are 18 and 19. And we spent it in hell. It was crazy. And I finally went out, and it was like being in an abusive relationship. You have so much involved that you just don't want to call it quits because that would be admitting you were dumb. And that's hard to do, right? And so finally, I went to visit a friend of mine who had built a new house, and they'd started their house after we started ours, and they were in their house, and it was done and finished, and they'd spent about half of what we had spent on our house. And I walked in, and I said, "Your walls are straight. You have, there aren't those little funky holes on the side of every outlet in the house. Wow." And so we hired their contractor to come over. We asked him to come over and take a look at our house. And he walked through our house, and he's like, "Oh, wow. I've never seen anything this bad." He said, "Have you watched Homes on Homes?" He goes, "They've never done one like this. This is just crazy." This guy was a total moron, but he is a con artist. He snowed us. And it's not like we don't know anything about construction. We have built hay barns and things. It was just...
It was just crazy. So that's why there was not a book until Fair Game, because I couldn't write anything until we fired him last September. And then I wrote Fair Game after he left. And I knew what was going on in my head. I knew what the story was. But I couldn't write. The words would not come out of my head into my fingers that you would want to read until he left. So, and had I realized that before, I would have fired him earlier. But in the meantime, I've hired my very best friend as a personal assistant. She is a bookkeeper, so she can do that month and a half of paperwork I have to do every year for the IRS. She does it for me now. The terrible guilty feeling I get every day looking at my email, knowing that if I sit down to write email, I'm going to spend 3 hours answering email, and then I won't want to write anymore. So she does that. And believe me, you'd rather have an answer from her, because she's really funny. And she's smart, and she's cool. And our lives are much better, and I'm writing a lot faster. I'm going to have Frostburn done by June, which makes me early in turning in a book for the first time since I turned in Mooncalled. So I figure that I should bring my editor's blood pressure down a little bit, and we should be able to get going. I'm not sure if I can write a book every 6 months. That was really hard. But I think I can do a book every 9 months and still produce a book you guys want to read. So that's the goal, and we'll see how we do on it. I also like to do some more short stories. Yes?
What are your thoughts on this recent flood of the supernatural? Blue Blood, you've got all this vampire TV show.
Right. As a writer, and this is my means of making a living, I say if it is done well, it is awesome. It can only help. Joss Whedon's Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel helped. Anybody who is a good storyteller who comes in and writes things and brings people into it is awesome. Supernatural is a great series. Grimm, I have to wait till it comes out on DVD, because we do Netflix, and we live out in the boonies. And so we do Netflix, and then occasionally I'll look it on the web, but our email, our internet is slow enough that it makes it tough to download the things on the web. But if it's good, it's awesome. What worries me about the writing genre is that because for such a long time it was the only happy place, urban fantasy was the only happy place, urban fantasy and paranormal romance were the only happy places in publishing, that we had a lot of second-rate storytellers come in. And what that does is it means people say, oh, I wonder if I like urban fantasy. And they pick up the book and they go, oh, it's okay. And they never pick up another one. As long as, when urban fantasy meant you picked up a Laurel K. Hamilton or a Charlene Harris or a Jim Butcher or a Carrie Vaughn or a Kelly Armstrong or a Kim Harrison. I just did the signing with Kim Harrison yesterday. That was cool. We do a pretty good stand-up routine, the two of us. This is our third time, so it's awesome. When you're picking up those books, it doesn't matter if you would really normally like vampire and werewolf stuff, because they're such good storytellers that make you like it anyway. And then you go, oh, I like urban fantasy, and what you really mean is I like good storytelling, right? What happened is we have a whole bunch of people who will, maybe when they write 5 or 6 books, will be awesome. But first books, and I speak from experience, first books suck. They do. And if you are writing in a really popular genre, you can get published before maybe you ought to be published. And that doesn't do anybody, including the writer, any good. So my answer is, the good stuff is awesome, and I'm so excited about True Blood. Is awesome. It is great. And the one they did for the Harry Dresden was sucked. And I'm a big Jim Butcher fan. I just love Harry Dresden. And the first time I watched the Sci-Fi Channel series, I'm going, really? Really? They gave him a Jeep and a hockey puck? What do they not know about Harry Dresden? Looks like a wizard storming through the city of Chicago with his big cloak and his huge stick. And people go, you're weird, right? So they missed it. And the very last two episodes started to get it, and they were much better, the last couple. Nothing to do with the actors. The acting was great. It was the writing and the way they set it up. They didn't understand what they had. So I'm hoping it'll get better. So my answer to your question is, I'm really excited about the good stuff and not so excited about the bad stuff. Okay. Okay, I'm sorry. See, I could talk here all night. Yes, go ahead.
I am very much enjoying your concept of time illness or time
Yeah.
Like Samuel.
Right. Right. Right.
And with people getting time crazy, it's very interesting. And I know, you know, I've seen bits and pieces of it, but you seem to really delve into it. How did you develop that?
You know, I go by the acting school of writing, which means you put yourself into the footprints of, or you put yourself into the shoes of the people who are writing. And I can think of nothing more scary than living forever. You talk to, some of my family were very long-lived, and as they get into their 80s and 90s, when all of their friends are gone, and all of their children are gone, and all of anybody who meant anything have already gone, and they're ready to go. And I thought, how about if you were 800 years old, and not only are all your friends and family and people you loved gone, and then the new people, the new mortals, it's like, talk to a Vietnam vet about what it was like when the new people came in, because the number of brand new soldiers in Vietnam who died in the first 2 or 3 days the percentage was incredibly high. They didn't want to talk to them. They wouldn't look at them, because if they connected with them and then they died, it would hurt too much. So I just took that to its natural conclusion. For me, it was just I would not want to be immortal. And I had this talk with another urban fantasy writer. I won't tell you who it was. And she goes, oh, no, I'd love to be immortal. I'm going, you're crazy. Absolutely crazy. I think that's the worst curse you could ever have. Okay, one more question, and then we're done. I thank you. Whoever's alarm went off, that was good. Ooh. Yes, go ahead.
You did a great book for Subterranean Press.
Yes.
Do you have any projects like that?
The Alpha and Omega book was actually a novella, and it appeared first in On the Prowl with Karen Chance, Sunny, and Tempting Fate. Help me.
Wait, I have it here.
Oh, do you? Okay. I love her book. She's awesome, and I can't believe the name has gone. Although names do that to me. And Subterranean. Say that. Eileen Wilkes. Yeah. If you get a chance, read her. She's awesome. And then they said, "Oh, we really like my editors." I said, "Oh, we really like that book. Why don't you write a series on it?" So that's how the Alpha and Omega series happened. And Subterranean Press approached me and asked me if I had any short stories, and I don't write a lot of short stories. I'm writing more short stories now, which is a lot of fun, but I don't write short stories much, and they said, that's fine, we'll do whatever. And so we said, well, we have this Alpha and Omega, and they decided to do that, and they got a wonderful Italian artist to do the artwork, and it's on beautiful paper, and it's really, really beautiful, and now it's really, really expensive on Amazon, which really scares me. It's like $700, I think, is what it's going for. But if you want the story, you can download it for $2.99 as an ebook. But they have approached me. I've also been approached about doing new stories by Nick Brucci, A Dynamite, which is a kind of different version of a graphic thing. And I think we're going to try to do all of that. We'll just see how the books are the important thing. And as long as the books are going, then I can do extra projects. And if the books aren't going, then all I'm doing is books. So the answer is yes, we hope so. And they're excited to do some more. And I would love to. Thank you all. You rock. You're awesome.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.